G3. The Model of Being and Its Universal Laws. Number 12A.
Well, I still want to stay a little bit longer with that whole question of intellectual and spiritual, because in the whole we have put so much stress on understanding, on scientific understanding, so that perhaps we also should put a bit more stress on the spiritual side of understanding, so that we don't think always that only if we are intellectually correct and see things right and clear, that that is all what is needed. It isn't. And that's why I said that sentence at the end of the chapter, Genesis, always made such an impact on me, that the wise philosopher can be attracted and really be enthused about Christian Science, but they can't fathom it. Therefore, the question is also raised, right, also in the chapter on Genesis, how can mortals know the infinite? And ask oneself, well, knowing is knowing. Knowing has something to do with thinking, and thinking has something to do. Do we think logically, and is it reasonable what we think? And therefore we think all that is necessary, that is reasonable. And then we find suddenly an answer in that is completely different than what we expected. Namely, she says that mortals can know the infinite not until they throw off the old man and reach a spiritual image and likeness. Can you see? She doesn't answer it with an intellectual ability or faculty, but with a living sense. That they can't understand, that no matter how intellectual we are and how much we are trained educationally, we can't understand it until we throw off the old man. This is a different field of understanding. When we all come to the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man. Again, it's appealing to our manhood, to the structure and attitude of our manhood. We can't do things just with the brain. The brain also must sink down a little bit to the heart and wed itself with the heart. Until we come to a perfect man, to the measure and stature of the fullness of Christ. Can you see the measure of the Christ, the stature of the Christ? It is all appealing, so to say, to the manhood within us, to the true manhood and womanhood within us, that that is a measure of understanding, a means of understanding, a channel of understanding, not only the intellectual side. I say that especially because I'm allowed to do that, because from my background, I could be considered as an intellectual, as being academically trained, and therefore many students always say to me, well, we naturally didn't have that university training that you had, and therefore for you, you were trained in that way, and therefore you can understand Christian Science better than we can. We only had a little bit of schooling and so on, and that's nearly a disadvantage that I have, that I have to tell them that doesn't matter. On the contrary, it can be a hindrance to us, because one will put too much stress on the intellectual. And actually, when you experience that one presents this idea of Christian Science to the intellectuals, we have very little response, very little response. If you present it to the average one, to the normal people, we have response. Just as I said about my mother, the same thing I could tell about many, many other incidents in my field, about people who had practically no education. I think of a wonderful practitioner with a wonderful practice and great results and great success. He only had a few years schooling, and then he was a shepherd boy. And while he was a shepherd boy up in the Alps, and he was thinking about reality, something awoke in him and said, there is something more about life. And he made up his mind that there is something more about life. And then shortly afterwards, he met some of my colleagues that told him about the order of the 7 days of creation. And he was off. It was a write-off. It triggered him right off. And still today, he has no other education than that little bit that he had up in the village in the Alps, and you don't get that very, very far. You have to get up in the morning at 5 or 4 and look after the cows and so on before you go to school, perhaps even bring the milk to the various people, and then you go to school and are rather sleepy than in the schoolroom. They have to struggle through a few hours schooling and to go home and feed the cows and so on. So it is not dependent on academic or intellectual abilities alone. It can be a help, but it can also be a disadvantage. How many intellectuals we have touched with our teaching in the field? And very little response. Very little response. So cut that out. Cut it out. What is necessary is to be a normal thinker, quite a normal thinker. And that coupled with what is shown here, to try to get that measure and stature of the Christ. And that's an inward attitude, an attitude which we don't learn in school nor at the university, and especially not at the university. There we learn the very opposite of having the stature of the fullness of Christ. There we begin to fight who is the better student, who makes more progress, who gets the better marks, who has a better final exam, and so on. And the fighting and the competition begins right away. So Mrs. Eddy gives us quite a different line on how mortals can know the infinite. She says, mortal mind must awaken to spiritual life. See, she doesn't say, well, you have to be a good intellectual. It is actually hidden to the wise and prudent, but revealed unto babes. Again, that sense of receptivity that we will have. Again, that sense of the babe that looks into the world and sees the world as one big wonder and wonders about everything, cannot really fathom what's going on, just with eyes open and sees the new world. That's the babe within us. Let's be that babe within us. And always see there is so much more that can be seen, so much more is awaiting for us in the future. Let's have that wonderment that the baby has. The hearts of men must be made ready for it. You see, not the brain. To be like little children, she says, to worship the spiritual in truth, to set aside even the most cherished beliefs and practices. This is so difficult for many people, to let the old be forgotten and to get away and get on to a new track, to leave behind the cherished beliefs. We are, you know, one thing I learned at the university. Actually, I only learned 2 things at the university in 5 years from my professor. And the one was, don't ever fall in love with your subject. Because when one falls in love, in with the subject and cherishes really those beliefs and practices, one never gets away from them, because one loves them so much that one hangs on to it. And that shuts the door for advancement. So leave aside even the most cherished beliefs. To leave all for Christ, and this is naturally necessary. You see, to leave all for Christ has nothing to do with the intellectual side of the human being. It is that inward love that says, what is the most important thing in the world? That's the question. Can we put first things first in our lives? That's the question. Do we have the courage to stand for what we believe? Or do we give in from morning to night to the world, to the family, to our friends, to the church, to an organization, or to whatever? Do we give in? Or do we have guts enough to stand for what we think is the highest, the best, the most important? To put first things first. That's the very first thing we have to do. To leave all for Christ. You know, where does that come in, to leave all for Christ for the first time in a big way? The second chapter in the textbook, Atonement and Eucharist. And we have always seen that the students like to stay in prayer. They love prayer. Because prayer just gives a promise. It says, well, if you pray aright, your prayers will be answered. That's fine. Oh, that's wonderful. But when the second chapter comes and says, are you willing to leave everything for that prayer attitude, then all the excuses come. All the excuses come. Then they say, oh, I can't do that. I lose my friends in the church. Oh, I get quarrel with my teacher. Oh, this, oh, that, oh, the other. You see, that's not the holistic sense of prayer. Prayer is only prayer when it is coupled with all the other 15 chapters. Then it's holistic. And then you can see that. Think of John Dolly and also of Loris Sinton. They were teachers who were willing to pay the price. John Dolly was considered to be the best teacher at that time in the world, the best lecturer at that time in the world. But he was willing to leave all for Christ's sake. He lost all his friends. He lost all his esteem that he had in the world. Suddenly he was a black sheep, you know, etc. His practice could have been in danger. He could no more teach and so on. He didn't care about it. But there were many, many, many teachers and practitioners that did follow him up to that point. And when Boston cracked the whip, they all fled. They all fled. They wanted to have the big idea that in prayer, but not the dominant Eucharist. And that is the question, when can this idea go forward? Can only go forward, not only, and not in the first place, if we see this idea in a very strict and very wonderful way in its science. It's then when we see it in its science, plus the third side of the city, when we really stand up for it. If we put it first, if we leave all for that idea, then, when we have that attitude, which the first Christian had, which didn't mind to be crucified for their conviction, when they didn't mind to be put before the lions, then something happens, not before. Only with a clear presentation of the subject, we will not do it. We will not succeed. So, we have to be careful that our science is holistic. And here I mean now holistic in the world, holistic in the Christ, holistic in Christianity, and also holistic then in science. Or else this idea will not grow. In spite that it is seen as from the point of view of the scientific nature of it, it cannot grow without that we are showing forth the measure and the stature of the fullness of Christ. We must be willing to sacrifice everything for it. There was no other way we could do it up to now. And those few, you could be grateful for those few young people at the time of John Dolly. He was then already in his older age, and thank God he had a few students who were willing to sacrifice their whole life career for it. Not only just sacrifice an evening for study. We couldn't have excuses for anything. We always had, in every day, from morning to night, to put first things first. And only that devotion, which has nothing to do with seeing the signs a bit clearer than the other fellow, but which had to do with that attitude of spiritual attitude, do we actually give our whole to the idea? Or do we like to hang on to some of our cherished beliefs? This is the great question. Because we know that neither the sciences nor the churches are any help. They all will be of no help. We shouldn't even look at that for help. We shouldn't look at an organization or at a church for help. Mrs. Eddy says it very definitely in the sixth chapter. Sorry, I come back to the sixth chapter. Very definitely that the churches will not accept it. And we are a fool to think that they will accept it. The Christian Science is not a matter of an organization. It's a matter, do we have the measure and stature of the fullness of Christ within us? That matters. And that alone matters. So churches, organizations, they are no help and should be of no help. We should not even ask that they are of help, that they support us, because then we would ask error to support us, because churches and organizations are human constructs and not divine constructs. So we should not ask for them, not even look out for them, and by heaven's sake, not fight with them. Not fight with them. That's going further down the drain. To fight against error is error. That's not divine science. It's accepting that there is, besides the whole, something else that is intelligent, that is powerful, that is important, that's duality in its worst sense. So we stand with our whole being for this idea. Again, naturally, the question comes up, but are not the sciences, the philosophies, any help for us to understand this science? And we have to answer that question, because it's a right question and a good question that says, well, here we come and say, Mrs. Eddy comes and says, here I have found a new revelation, I have found a new science, the science of Christ, the science of holistic science. What about all those many thousands and thousands of great thinkers, of wonderful people, of wonderful men and women that have gone on before? Are they not a help to us? And this is a question she asks in the sixth chapter too. The sixth chapter is full of that problem. She says, yes, and she speaks about the Socratic, the Platonic, the Spencerian system. She says, yes, some particular system of human opinions that they may have occasional gleams of divinity borrowed from that truly divine science. So she does not say, well, all that went before her were no good, that they were not seeing something. But she makes it very clear that they had occasional gleams. And on this point I want to put my stress. But nevertheless, she said, they remain wholly human in their origin and tendency. So if we want to see the real paradigm shift, we must see how does modern science or new science differentiate itself from old science. Not that it differentiates itself that old science was all wrong, but something else. They have also seen something which she said was borrowed from divine science. They have occasional gleams. That's why we like to go back very often to the old thinkers and see what they already have seen, that they already have, say, put forward the same fundamental question that needs to be answered even today. She says, human reason, which we have seen, well, human reason, we should have divine logic. So human reason is already a questionable thing, she says, but human reason dimly reflects and feebly transmits Jesus' works and words. So still there is a dim sense about it that can be of some help. Or she says that human philosophy, physiology, and hygiene afford faint gleams of God truth. So you see, she does not away completely with all what has gone before, with the thinkers before, but she makes a difference and says, yes, there were occasional gleams, faint gleams that were of any help. They dimly reflected really the truth. She even says that human capacity is slow to discern and to grasp God's creation. So again, we have that which we were considering yesterday, how Dunois said there are always two ways of attaining the goal. The one is revelation, which is very rare, true divine revelation, and there is the other road, the other way, the road of reason, which is slow, a step-by-step development. So naturally, we as holistic scientists, or let's say as those who can see that holistic science should be the answer, we naturally have to see that we have to see through that road of reason to that extent that it slowly develops to that stage where we are ready for revelation, that we are seeing that revelation should not be excluded from our way of investigation. Just by saying, well, that's left to one in a thousand year, 500 year, we have people who have real revelation, like the prophets had it, or Moses perhaps had it, then after another 500 years, perhaps Jesus had it, and perhaps after another 1800 years, Mrs. Eddy had it. This is not science to think that we are excluded from revelation. Real science would have to teach us, and that only a holistic science can do that, would have to teach us how we can culture ourselves that we are transparent for revelation. So that actually our understanding would not have to come entirely through the road of reason, that we may start with the road of reason, but with a very specific aim, not with the specific aim that that is our destiny, that for our, all our lifetime we do not belong to that elite that has revelation, but that has to growl on the ground like a worm and see how he gets on, can never fly, that we have a method of a culture, method of awareness that says, okay, at the present moment it doesn't seem that just a revelation breaks on me with such effulgence that it turns everything upside down, that it brings in a new paradigm. All right, I don't yet have that feeling, but that is my aim. And therefore, I take those steps which will lead me to that point. Why? Because Mrs. Eddy says that science reveals. She doesn't say, dear God Almighty, sometime in a mystical way reveals. She says about 36 times in the textbook that science reveals, that divine science reveals, that Christian science reveals, science reveals, science reveals, science reveals, and never says God reveals, which I must say again has made a terrific impact on my consciousness as a youngster. It seems as a youngster one is very receptive for important changes, for important points that are really fundamental. And I could see right from my students' day that science reveals, which says a science is that which we can learn in an ordered way. Therefore, I can learn science, and if I learn science in a proper way, I have found the key for divine revelation. So that the development of the scientific idea little by little is no more dependent on the road of reason, but becomes more and more an occasion where suddenly somehow a new idea breaks into our consciousness without having expected it, very often without at the first moment seeing its impact, its greatness, very often only retrospectively, after years, one can see the bigness of what has happened.